I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last week, the U.S. abstained from voting on a U.N. Security Council resolution condemning Israeli settlements. Yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry gave a speech at the State Department about the U.S.-Israeli relationship, his vision for peace in the Middle East, and support for a two-state solution that Kerry says is being endangered by the expansion of Israeli settlements.
Here is a fundamental reality. If the choice is one state, Israel can either be Jewish or democratic. It cannot be both. And it won't ever really be at peace.
Kerry also criticized Hamas and Palestinians who have resorted to violence.
Most troubling of all, Hamas continues to pursue an extremist agenda. They refuse to accept Israel's very right to exist. They have a one-state vision of their own. All of the land is Palestine. Hamas and other radical factions are responsible for the most explicit forms of incitement to violence. And many of the images that they use are truly appalling. And they are willing to kill innocents in Israel and put the people of Gaza at risk in order to advance that agenda.
The Obama administration and the government of Prime Minister Netanyahu have had a strained relationship, and the last few days underscore the frustration, the anger, even hostility. Incoming President Donald Trump tweeted before Kerry's speech, "We cannot continue to let Israel be treated with such total disdain and disrespect. They used to have a great friend in the U.S., but no more. Stay strong, Israel. January 20th is fast approaching." We asked Ambassador Dennis Ross to join us. He has worked on shaping U.S. policy towards the Middle East for over 30 years in the first Bush administration, in the Clinton administration, also as a special assistant to President Barack Obama. He's currently the William Davidson Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a distinguished professor in the practice of diplomacy at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. Wrote a book called Doomed to Succeed, the U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama. Ambassador Ross, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
You're in Israel. What has been the response to Kerry's speech yesterday?
I think it's fair to say that there's been a lot of restrained enthusiasm. You have, I think, not surprisingly, the government responding in a very strong manner. The Prime Minister of Israel said he was disappointed, didn't understand how, with everything going on in the Middle East, in Syria and Iraq, how the Secretary of State could give a 75-minute speech on this issue and put so much of the attention on the settlement issue. Others within Israel, some who are critics of the government, I think, have flagged what they see as some of the truths that they felt that Secretary Kerry was identifying. Ehud Barak, in particular, tweeted that that what the Secretary outlined was some important truths that Israel couldn't run away from. So I think there's overall there's probably been that kind of slant more that's negative rather than positive, but it reflects some of the differences here in Israel that you might expect.
Was the response, did John Kerry say anything yesterday that really has deviated from U.S. policy towards Israel in previous administrations, or was it that it was public and the tone and perhaps even some of the words that he used that has rankled some?
It's a very good question. I would say that it was less the remarks themselves, and it was probably more the timing, the context, and in a sense, the kind of message that he knows better what's good for Israel than Israelis know for themselves. That's one theme I have to say that I've heard repeatedly today from people here, including some people who would otherwise not necessarily be critical of Secretary Kerry. I think that was probably one of the messages that has emerged more clearly among many Israelis that I've spoken to than others.
You have worked with President Obama directly, and I'm just curious about, do you know how much he knew about what Kerry would say?
Oh, I'm sure that he knew what the thrust of it was going to be. A speech like this would go through a number of drafts. It would be circulated to the White House, would be cleared by the White House. And I'm sure that even though the president isn't at the White House right now, the draft of this was probably sent to him after it was reviewed by people on the NSC. So I don't think there was anything that was a surprise about the speech to the president. What is interesting, I would say, in the end, this is a speech that outlines a number of principles. They're not dramatically different from the Clinton parameters, which I obviously was involved with. In the Clinton administration, the difference, of course, again, is because of the context. Those parameters emerged after intensive direct negotiations. We might have been a part of those negotiations, but they were direct negotiations. This is a speech that has emerged after having had no negotiations for the last years. So context is different, and also not significantly, it was the president who put out the Clinton parameters and then subsequently made a speech. Here it's the Secretary of State making this speech, the president making the speech.
I have to say we don't have the greatest phone line. We will carry on and hopefully can get you loud and clear, or louder and clearer. Are you saying, Ambassador Ross, that the U.S. under Secretary of State Kerry has not brokered or sat down with members of the Israeli government, of the Palestinian leadership, to talk about peace?
No, I'm saying he has done that, but the difference was in the Clinton administration, we were directly involved with the parties the way Secretary Kerry has been. The difference is the parties were talking to each other. Since, really, for the last couple of years, there's been almost no direct conversations between the parties. And the effort that was made by Secretary Kerry back in 2013 through 2014 was his going between the parties, not so much the parties talking to each other. When the Clinton parameters were presented, they came as a result of the two sides asking the administration to offer a bridging proposal in response to their inability on their own, when they were talking to each other, to overcome their differences. So the context was very different from that standpoint. As I said, the other big difference is it's the Secretary of State making this speech. It's not the President of the United States making the speech.
And it's less than a month before President Trump takes office. Why the timing of this speech? You mentioned this earlier, you know, less than about 3 weeks or so before this new administration comes in with clearly a very different policy approach to Israel.
I mean, I think this, again, is an important question. And I'm not sure that I fully understand the answer, but I guess my guess on this is a function of the Israeli administration, the Israeli government, going through a process where there's an effort to, within the Knesset, to have new legislation that would authorize what have been previously unauthorized settler outposts. I think this is something that probably had an effect on the administration almost more than anything else. It is understandably a reaction to a belief that if the Israelis adopt that kind of a legislation, it suggests that there'll be really no real limitations to Israeli settlement activity, not in terms of size, but also not in terms of location. One of the things I have to say that surprises me a little bit about the administration, especially with the Security Council resolution and even in the speech yesterday, because Secretary Kerry put such a premium on concerns about the drift towards one state, it is interesting that the administration has never adopted a differentiated approach to settlement activity. What I mean by that is every settlement that the Israelis built, all activity beyond the June 467 lines, is greeted by intense criticism by the administration. And yet there are settlements there are units that are being built in what might be described as settlement blocks that are close to the 67 lines. And that going back to Camp David in the year 2000, there was an idea that you could have settlement blocks and swaps. In about 5% of the West Bank, you can accommodate about 80% of the settlers. So if building was taking place only within those settlement blocks, which are likely to remain part of Israel in any peace agreement, that would still be consistent with a two-state outcome. If you could freeze building outside the blocks, again, you're doing something that is consistent with a two-state outcome. You've not seen the Obama administration make an effort to try to produce that kind of an outcome, which actually might have produced a response within Israel. Even if the Palestinians wouldn't necessarily embrace it, at least you would be doing something to forestall the drift towards one state. And that seemed to be such a major theme for Secretary Kerry that it is surprising that the administration hasn't been willing to adopt that kind of a position.
Secretary Kerry said that that we, meaning the Obama administration, has done more for Israel than any other administration. I'm also looking at something that Tom Friedman wrote in the New York Times today. He says, I've covered this issue, this, of course, issue meaning Israel and Palestine, my entire adult life, and have never met two U.S. leaders more committed to Israel as a Jewish democracy. What do you say to that?
Well, I think it's a fair point. On when it comes to security, the administration has been very responsive. It has been prepared to criticize the Israelis for their settlement activity. But the issue they're criticizing is, how does Israel retain its Jewish democratic character? Much of what Secretary Kerry was raising yesterday, even though, again, I think the Israeli government didn't really like the thrust of it, the Israeli government also didn't respond to one clear message that he was suggesting. And that one clear message was, if nothing is done to change the current path that Israel is on, it will become a single state, it will become a binational state. And that does reflect, I think, a genuine concern on the part of Kerry and President Obama. And it isn't something that's being answered by the current Israeli government.
Well, we're up on a break here, and the phone line sounds a little bit better, Ambassador Rosser. We're going to stay with you. Let me go back to something that Kerry said. He said the Israeli prime minister publicly supports a two-state solution, but his current coalition is the most right-wing in Israeli history, with an agenda driven by its most extreme elements. The result is the policies of this government, which the prime minister himself just described as more committed to settlements than in any in Israeli history, are leading in the opposite direction towards one state. About 30 seconds before our break, but I'm curious what you say back to that.
Well, I think it's a legitimate point. I think the challenge for this Israeli government, for this prime minister who says he's committed to two states for two peoples, is to have policies to reflect that. One legitimate issue that Kerry was raising was the current path is one that is not consistent with preventing a binational state.
That is Dennis Ross, our guest in this first half of Radio Times. He worked on Middle East issues and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict under the first Bush administration, under the Clinton administration. He was a special assistant to President Barack Obama. We are talking about Secretary of State John Kerry's speech yesterday, of course, incoming President Donald Trump, and his focus on the Middle East as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking today about Secretary of State John Kerry's speech yesterday and the strained U.S.-Israeli relationship with Ambassador Dennis Ross of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just read a couple of comments. One, Mike from Wilmington, please discuss the notion that without an independent Palestinian state, Israel will fail as a democratic Jewish state due to increasing Arab population and the apartheid policies that would become increasingly necessary. An email from a New Jersey listener, why would a president do this with 22 days left in office? Clearly, it was his completion of making the Middle East a complete disaster. Good work, Barack Hussein Obama. Email from Paul, how can anyone be sure that a new autonomous Palestinian state in the West Bank will not soon become like Hamas or ISIS and attack Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, Haifa, just as Hamas attacks civilians in southern Israel? Before we hear from you, Dennis Ross, let me just play something that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said yesterday in response to Secretary of State John Kerry's speech.
Israelis do not need to be lectured about the importance of peace by foreign leaders. Israel's hand has been extended in peace to its neighbors from day one, from its very first day. We pray for peace. We've worked for it every day since then. And thousands of Israeli families have made the ultimate sacrifice to defend our country and advance peace.
I don't need to tell you, Ambassador Ross, that the negotiations for a Middle East peace have been going on for decades. Is it time to call it quits?
No, I don't think it's time to call it quits, but I do think one of the things that, again, was sort of lacking from Secretary Kerry's approach was an understanding that the effort to resolve everything hasn't worked. So if you create a kind of binary choice where it's all or nothing, unfortunately, the pattern of peacemaking in the Middle East has been when you make it all or nothing, you produce nothing. And I'm concerned in some respects that the gap between Israelis and Palestinians today is as bad as at any point since I've been interested or working on this problem. There's a complete level of disbelief between the two sides. The idea that you can present a set of principles that the two sides would now embrace and use that as a basis for negotiations, given this context of complete disbelief, I think is an illusion. So what is needed is to focus on how do you restore a sense of possibility? If both sides say they're committed to two states, why not focus on getting each side to take some steps that would demonstrate they're committed to two states, as opposed to trying to come up with an approach that says, here are the principles that will resolve the conflict. You have a psychological gap that is so profound now. You have a political gap that is so profound now. And you have a new administration coming in, and we have no real idea of how they're even going to approach the issue. So putting this out at this point may well have been, I think, driven by Secretary Kerry's frustration more than anything else, and his desire, in some ways almost, I described it on Israeli radio this morning, as wanting to get something off of his chest. That seems to be sort of the tenor in which I think the speech was given.
But what we hear from Benjamin Netanyahu, from the prime minister, is that we will meet with Abbas, but no preconditions. We hear from Abbas, we'll first stop the settlement activity, and then we will meet with you. Is that part of the problem?
It is part of the problem, because right now there have been no negotiations between the two sides really for the last couple of years. And as I said earlier, even when Secretary Kerry was making his intensive effort, he was going back and forth between the two sides. They weren't actually talking to each other. It's really hard, I think, to transform the relationship between the two sides when they're not even dealing directly. And so I think you got to go back to the basics. At this point, I would say restoring a sense of possibility, restoring believability again in peacemaking is really the first order of business. And thinking that you can solve the whole conflict when you're at such a psychological disjuncture, when you're with such a psychological gap, again, I really think that's not the most productive way to proceed.
The U.S. Earlier this year approved a $38 billion security aid package for the next 10 years. And this was something that was negotiated with the Obama administration. So we've got this argument going back and forth, but at the same time, the U.S. approved a lot of money for the Israeli government, especially to be used for security. Right. How do we reconcile this?
Well, that's why I say, for those who want to come out and say that President Obama was anti-Israeli or John Kerry was anti-Israeli, it doesn't square with the kind of positions that they've actually adopted on security. This is a 10-year $38 billion commitment to Israeli security that is a profound commitment. So it shouldn't be diminished. And because you disagree on the peace issue, it can't become a device to somehow suggest that the U.S. Relationship with Israel is somehow, in shambles. It's not. And the nature of the commitment is still there. What has been true in the Obama administration, and in some ways I kind of recount this in my book, In some ways, it's reminiscent of what you saw in the Bush 41 administration, a readiness to stand by Israel on security issues, but no hesitancy to be critical of Israel in public. And that is very unsettling for some Israelis. It's very unsettling for some who look at the U.S.-Israeli relationship. They see whenever there's a kind of public discord between the United States and Israel, it makes them uneasy for good reason in some sense, too, because when the U.S. opens up a kind of public breach with Israel, it gives a kind of license to others to do even more. You see, for example, in Europe, you'll see countries prepared to do even more. So that creates a degree of being unsettled. And one of the things that has contributed, I think, to the perception of President Obama and his and the feeling that somehow he's not been as supportive of Israel has been no reluctance to be critical of Israel in public. And by the way, there hasn't been the same kind of readiness to be critical of the Palestinians in public. What was interesting about the Kerry speech yesterday was he said we have been constantly critical of the Palestinians about incitement. Well, in fact, actually, that hasn't been the case, at least not in public. And yesterday, that was somewhat different. So this image of being prepared to be quick to criticize the Israelis but not so quick to criticize the Palestinians, that is something that has contributed to the perception of the administration not being as friendly to Israel as some other administrations.
You've been involved in this issue for decades now. Is Israel more or less isolated than it was, let's say, back in the first Bush administration?
It is not more isolated, and that's because of what's going on in the region.
Right.
Israel's relationship today, in practical terms, with Egypt, with Jordan, with some of the other Sunni Arab states is unprecedented. Now, that's not a function of the Palestinian issue. The fact that it's their cooperation is in private is because the Palestinian issue requires, from the standpoint of these leading Arab, of these different Arab leaders, to keep the relationship with Israel, in a sense, at a low visible ebb or, in a sense, below the radar screen. But from a practical, tangible standpoint, what Israel is doing with a number of Arab states today is unprecedented because those Arab states see the same threats that Israel sees. They see Israel as a natural partner for the Gulf states. They see Israel as a natural partner against the Iranians. For Egypt and Jordan, they see Israel as a natural partner against ISIS and related radical Sunni Islamist threats. So you do have Israel in a situation where in the region, what's practically going on, we've actually never seen before. And internationally, economically at least, the relationship with China, with India, again, is beyond anything we've really seen before. Now, that doesn't translate diplomatically, and it doesn't translate in places like the UN. So from an economic standpoint, Israel is doing extremely well on the world stage, particularly given its high-tech sector. From a political diplomatic standpoint, it's doing less well.
Just a minute or two before we have to say goodbye to you, the new president, Donald Trump, has selected a man named David Friedman to be the next ambassador to Israel. What suggestions do you have? And it's clear that there's a very different approach towards Israel and this conflict coming from Trump based on the things that he has tweeted and also based on his pick for U.S. ambassador.
Certainly those are indications that suggest that the tone with Israel will be dramatically different. We don't yet know if there are indications of what the policy will be. His choice for Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, is someone who has never been to Israel, but he has a lot of experience in the Arab world. His choice for Secretary of Defense, Folk was the head of the Central Command, where he spent an enormous amount of time in the Middle East, but not very much time in Israel because Israel is not part of the Central Command. They may bring to bear a set of perspectives on the region that might not be the same as David Friedman, who is the person who's been appointed as his ambassador. And we also have Donald Trump saying he would like to be the one to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He thinks it's the ultimate deal. He said he has reason to believe he can do it. Well, again, those are the kinds of statements that suggest that the kind of policy he'll actually adopt may well be different than what we've heard him say up until now. I'm one of those who says, let's wait and see what they actually do before we express a high degree of confidence about what the policies will actually be.
Friedman did say some controversial things, including calling J Street, which is a, I guess, a more liberal Israeli lobbyist group here in the United States, calling them worse than capos. And, of course, those were the concentration camp prisoners assigned to supervise Jewish prisoners in concentration camps.
Yeah, I've said that that's the kind of language that's really beyond the pale. And I can only hope that he got caught up in the heat of a political campaign. When he's ambassador in Israel, he represents all Americans, and he'll be receiving all sorts of different Jewish groups, and he'll also be having outreach to all sorts of different Israelis. So I suspect that when he has responsibilities, I suspect and I hope that his posture will be somewhat different.
Well, Ambassador Ross, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he's been joining us from Israel, has been working in the Middle East, on the Middle East, for the last couple of decades. Currently a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, a professor of diplomacy at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, and wrote a book called Doomed to Succeed, The U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama. Well, joining us now is Ilan Goldenberg. He's senior fellow and director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New America Security. He served as the chief of staff to the special envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations at the U.S. Department of State, where he was part of a small team supporting Secretary Kerry's initiative to conduct permanent status peace negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. And Ilan Goldenberg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
Is the two-state solution dead?
No, I mean, maybe it's on life support, I would say. It's pretty clear that, as you know, as Dennis said, we've had years now where the situation seems to be getting worse. The parties are not trusting each other. The personal relationship, the disbelief amongst the people on both sides, the general populations is low. But there's still a couple of things that give me hope. One is that there still is no better alternative, and nobody has come up with a viable alternative as of yet. And so that means that keeps the two-state solution on the table and has for a very long time. The types of things Secretary Kerry was talking about, the types of parameters are still the only viable parameters, I think, that you see for a solution to the conflict. Also, I would argue that, you know, the majority in both sides still want the two-state solution, and polling shows that. What it shows is that they don't believe the other side wants it and that they don't trust the other side to implement it. So, you know, with the right willingness and the right people, you could get to, I think, a two-state agreement. What you really need, I think, is different leadership on both sides and a different political makeup on both sides, which I don't think is impossible. I mean, Abbas and Netanyahu, I believe both of them ultimately would want to come to a two-state agreement, but both of them are incredibly risk-averse politicians. They really don't like and don't trust each other. And they're just not the types of leaders who are going to really take their people and move them and do bold and risky things that are to move their people to where they need to go. They're not, you know, people like a Sadat, like a Begin or a Rabin or a Sharon. So I think with different leadership on both sides, the conditions still exist for a two-state agreement down the road.
At some point there will be different leadership, but different could be the same. It could be more extreme. Secretary of State Kerry talked about the government in Israel being more right-wing than in years.
Yeah, no, that's true. But, you know, let's not forget that, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu had a very tough election just a couple of years ago. And, you know, if you look back at the United States, 10 years ago, we were talking about a permanent conservative majority. 5 years ago, progressives were on the ascendance, and we couldn't imagine somebody like a Donald Trump. And yet here we are. So, you know, think about it, things can change relatively quickly. And on the Palestinian side, look, I think whoever you get after Abbas, and it'll be turbulent and difficult, they might be less, in some ways they could be worse or on some issues, but they might be more, at least strong leaders that have more of political, consolidated political support of their population. And that's what you need. You think the problem with Abbas is not his unwillingness or his lack of desire to make peace. It's the fact that he's weak and is not willing to take political risks. So, you know, you could argue that even more right-wing hardline actors on both sides, if they were more willing to take risks and could develop relationships with each other, could still get to an agreement.
About a minute before our break here, but Ilan, you have worked with Secretary Kerry, and he has been criticized not just for the speech itself, but for the tone, the very, I would say, overt criticism of Israel over its expanding settlements. Is this the Kerry that you know?
Well, look, we can talk more after the break, but I'll say, having listened to that speech yesterday, that is absolutely the Kerry that I know, and that not the criticism, but you cannot walk away from that speech. Whether you agree with the speech, disagree with the speech, wonder about the timing, it's clear that the man deeply cares about the Jewish state. It's clearly he deeply cares about the future of the Jewish state. It's clear that he deeply cares about Israelis and Palestinians and has been invested in trying to solve this conflict for a long time, and that's the type of dedication and vigor that I saw from him in relentless pursuit of it when I worked for him. And so, you know, you can get into, obviously, you know, there's been a lot of mistakes and problems on all sides for the last 8 years, Israelis, Palestinians, Americans, everyone. You know, there's things that could have been done differently on all sides. But you can't argue with the fact that John Kerry is deeply dedicated to this issue and deeply cares about all of the parties involved in a really meaningful way.
Well, let's take this short break. We'll pick up on that. That's Ilan Goldenberg, Senior Fellow and Director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We are talking about John Kerry's speech yesterday, what it means, where it goes, and of course, the Middle East. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Ilan Goldenberg about Secretary of State John Kerry's speech yesterday about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and expressing some of his frustration about inaction on these critical issues. Let me play just a short clip where Kerry does acknowledge there's a new administration coming in and the possibility of new policies. Let's give it a listen.
President Obama and I know that the incoming administration has signaled that they may take a different path and even suggested breaking from the longstanding U.S. policies on settlements, Jerusalem, and the possibility of a two-state solution. That is for them to decide. That's how we work. But we cannot, in good conscience, do nothing and say nothing when we see the hope of peace slipping away.
Ilan, who was the audience, who was the audience, do you think, for John Kerry's speech?
I think that the audience was probably Israelis, Palestinians, the international community, American Jews, you know, the Arab world. I think across the board, what you're seeing, look, I think one of the reasons Kerry gave this speech, and I agree that, you know, I personally believe it would have been a better speech 2 or 3 years ago. I think it was an incredible speech. I think from the perspective of, and would have been a much more deeply meaningful, you know, in 2014, for example, his description of the problems associated with the settlements, I think, was the most eloquent and detailed that you'd heard from anybody, any American official ever give. And then, you know, laying out the parameters, which honestly aren't all that different than where they were in 2000. But I think the motivations were a couple. One, you know, we do have a new administration coming in, and we don't know precisely where Trump is going to go. But some of the early indicators, especially is the decision on his next American ambassador to Israel, are not good, as you've discussed.
Right.
And so this was partially meant for everybody else. So even if the United States walks away from 50 years of supporting the two-state solution, which I'm not sure we will, but even if it does, even if it takes a different approach on settlements than it's ever taken in the past, you're still going to have others who are making this case. You know, Israelis, Palestinians, and the international community, quite frankly, countries in Europe and others who have taken a back seat to the United States, who might have to step up and play a more direct role, or at least be the ones to try and convince right-wing Israeli governments that the going too far is not a good idea, and also pressing the Palestinians. And so I think Kerry's speech and, quite frankly, the UN Security Council resolution last week were at least partially meant to strengthen the hand of those actors who might be around after January 21st in the event that a Trump administration goes in a very different direction in terms of its views on the two-state solution. There's also a value, I think, for Kerry. You know, the negotiations he conducted were only the third final status negotiations ever conducted between these two parties in the history of the conflict. So they negotiate a lot. They argue a lot, mostly about small, silly stuff, not the big issues. Kerry, you know, in 2013-14, we really actually did have a process over the big issues. It was a difficult process. They don't like each other, and they didn't spend a lot of time talking to each other. We spent a lot of time shuttling between them. But, you know, it was still important for people, I think, to hear, as the person who presided over those, what came out of them in his perspective. And so, you know, as I said, 2 years ago would have been a lot better, but there's still, I think, an important value in doing this now.
You talked right before the break about how much Kerry cares and cared about this issue. Do you think caring more than President Obama himself?
No, I think the president deeply cares about this issue, too. But I think the president was already deeply frustrated with Netanyahu and Abbas and the whole process after his experiences in the first term. And so in the second term, I think he did leave it more to Kerry to lead on. And the president, I think, is, you know, they come from different places. Kerry, you know, for Kerry, he was at a point in his career where he just didn't care. He just wanted to try and do what was best purely from a policy perspective on the issues he cared about and was willing to drive as hard as he could at it. For Obama, there's always more trade-offs as the president, looking at other issues, looking at, you know, his domestic priorities, looking at, you know, at other challenges and saying, how much do I put into this? What kind of political backlash am I going to get if I go too far on this or that? And do I really want to spend that capital there? And so I think that that's a difference in approach between the president and the secretary, which might explain how sometimes they came down on slightly different positions on this. Because I think if it was just up to Kerry, he would have given this speech 2 years ago. You know, but I think at the time, you know, I think the president would have supported him giving this speech 2 years ago if it had come at a time when he thought it would have made a huge difference, i.e. while the negotiations were still ongoing. You know, I think there was a bit of a difference between the two of them where, you know, Obama's approach, you know, when we were getting near the end of the negotiations, I think Kerry's view was, I can convince these guys behind closed doors. And so let's wait on the speech and doing something publicly until we get to a point where that's no longer possible. While Obama's perspective was, if the speech moves them forward, let's do it. Then after the negotiations collapsed, I think Kerry was ready to do the speech. Obama said, what's the point of doing the speech if it's not going to actually move them forward? So I think there's a bit of a difference in perspective between the two, but deep caring from both about the overall issue.
And one wonders about the relationship between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu, just how much that has colored negotiations or perhaps even the lack of progress on this. There were a number of, I think you could describe as disses that happened over the last 8 years or so. How much do you think that's a factor on the fact that there hasn't been much progress? And it should be said, same true for both Bush administrations, Clinton administrations, Carter, Reagan, and others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, there's a long history of Israeli prime ministers and American presidents clashing over settlements. I've just been finishing Dennis Ross's book.
Oh, very good.
You know, as I know you had, and so I was just reading about these, Dennis categorizing the history of these clashes, whether it was Kissinger and Rabin in the 70s, Reagan and Begin in the early 80s, Shamir and Bush in the early 90s. There's been some really tough moments between Israeli prime ministers and American presidents. What's different here, I think, is, you know, usually when there was a major clash between the two, there'd be a domestic political cost for an Israeli prime minister to pay at home. But President Obama is really not popular in Israel for a number of reasons, I think. I think that the early Cairo speech without going visiting Israel, the early misstep, I think, on asking for a settlement freeze immediately, but also, a more right-wing government, less sympathetic to the president. And honestly, you know, some of the stuff that goes back even to 2007 and 2008 and the campaign, the sort of idea that the president was secretly a Muslim and some of those things all colored and weakened his ability to go over the Israeli prime minister's head as other American leaders have tried to do and sometimes unsuccessfully to the Israeli public. And so I think maybe more leverage on the Israeli side, though, you know, I think the Prime Minister Netanyahu has tried to go over the president's head a number of times.
That's right.
Which is also not unprecedented and has also been done by previous Israeli leaders to try and use support in the United States and Congress to pressure the executive, but also failed in doing that, especially on things that were of high priority to the president, such as the Iran deal. The one thing I'll say is the one thing in all of this, in my view, that was truly unprecedented over the last 8 years, including the UN Security Council resolution, which I don't think was unprecedented, and there's plenty of precedents for the U.S. abstaining on those. The one thing that actually was unprecedented was the prime minister going behind the president's back and coming to the United States and giving a speech in Congress trying to undermine a central foreign policy objective of the president of the United States. That was different and a huge problem. And, you know, for me, both sides mismanaged the relationship in all kinds of ways. But that's the one thing where I thought somebody crossed the line that really shouldn't have been crossed.
Let me read some comments. This one from Simons. According to my data, Israel has suffered less death and injury from war and terrorism during Obama's term than during any other presidency. Those critical of Obama should remember that now and going forward. Do you think that's true, Ilan?
I don't know. I'd have to take a look at the data. But I would say that, you know, I mean, there's no question the president has been deeply committed to Israel's security, the $38 billion deal just being the latest example. But, you know, I worked at the Pentagon for a number of years on Iran, and we spent so much time with our Israeli counterparts at the highest levels engaging with them on this issue. Even though we ended up disagreeing on the nuclear negotiations, the levels of deep coordination and camaraderie and working together that you just don't have with other partners and allies, and also the American investment in Iron Dome, which I think has been critical in protecting Israelis from rockets, and now I think deep American investments in counter-tunneling technology to work with the Israelis to deal with that potential threat coming from Gaza. So, you know, no one can, I think, accuse President Obama, Secretary Kerry, or anybody in this administration for not being fully behind Israel's security, even if, you know, we have some disagreements on the two-state solution, on settlements and other issues.
Let me read actually two interesting and kind of different emails here. One from John. He says, just on the surface, it seems to me that Israel's constant settlement building while negotiating is disingenuous. An email from Charlie. Over the last 40 years, it's been only Israel that's given up anything in pursuit of peace, Gaza for starters, and has got nothing in return from the Palestinians. And in many ways, Ilan, those are the two poles.
Right. And to some extent, both of those statements are true at the same time. You know, I think on settlements, yes, you know, my issue with settlements is, you know, you have 90,000. I mean, I have issues with settlements overall, but you have 90,000 now Israeli settlers living beyond the security barrier, east of the security barrier in the West Bank. This is a barrier unilaterally built by Israel that really was meant to signify, you know, what the final map might look like unilaterally, and was strongly objected to by the Palestinians and not accepted by the international community. And now the Israelis have put 90,000 people east of that barrier, and when they try to remove just a few hundred illegal, settlers who are in illegal outposts in Amona, which they have been trying to do for years now, it creates huge political controversy in Israel. So the more they build, the less likely you're going to – how are you going to move 90,000 people? I mean, it's just very hard to imagine. So, yes, it really does call into question Israeli credibility. On the other hand, you know, the Palestinians, you know, just look at their response to Kerry yesterday. Yeah, sure, we'll negotiate if the Israelis stop settlements. But no acknowledgement of the other things Kerry talked about, like the parameters for a final two-state agreement, the willingness to agree to some kind of language on Jewish state, a willingness to recognize Israel's security concerns, and adjust for them. There's plenty on the Palestinian side as well. And I would say that it's hard to say, well, the Palestinians should give more to Israel. But the Palestinians don't really have anything to give to Israel. Israelis really do hold all the cards with the Palestinians, but what the Arab world can give a lot to Israel. And so that's the dynamic you might want to try and set up. In exchange, the Arab world wants to work more closely with Israel. The Arab states want to cooperate with Israel on challenges like Iran, Syria, other things. They want economic relationships with a country that's been very economically successful. They want all these things. And so the real formula, I think, is Arab world recognition and engagement and cooperation with Israel in exchange for Israel making concessions to the Palestinians on issues that they care about. That's the formula for me. That's what Israel gets out of this equation.
Ilan, let me read another comment. This is from Scanning. I'm frustrated and disappointed by Israel's aggressive and negative response to the Obama administration U.S. abstention on the Security Council vote. 13 countries, I think it was 14 actually, voted yes, including China, France, Egypt, Great Britain. The U.S. has routinely subsidized the Israeli budget and has recently committed $38 billion, something I was talking with Ambassador Ross about. And again, I think that's a deeply held point of view.
Yeah. I don't blame the Israelis for responding the way they did to the Security Council resolution necessarily. Though I think there was a lot of politics there. I think, like the email points out, the U.S. only abstained. 14 other countries voted yes, and yet most of the vitriol and anger came at us.
Right.
Now that's, I think, partially explained by the fact that, you get angrier when your best friend does something that you don't expect them to do, as opposed to, folks who you don't expect to count on. Still, I think the Obama administration spent the last year signaling that they might do this. And I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu knew full well they might do this. Actually, he was quite afraid they were going to do this and was trying to find ways to head it off and has been for the last year, including trying to, change his coalition around so that he can pursue an initiative that would to create a more centrist coalition and then pursue initiatives that would head off these types of steps. So I don't think you can say that it was a total surprise.
Ilan, we're almost out of time here. Are the U.S. and Israel, are we best friends?
I still think the relationship's not going anywhere, especially since you have a new administration coming in who's going to take a very different tone. And I think at the end of the day, we still share a lot of security interests in common, deep security interests in the region. Israel remains remains our most reliable partner in the Middle East. Let's not forget the Israelis, for example, blew up a Syrian nuclear reactor 10 years ago very effectively with no noise. I mean, what other partners do we have that can do something like that? Not many. And whenever I worked with them at the Pentagon, they brought real value, insight, and good ideas to the table that helped our policy. So I think that and also the common values, history of relationship, democracy, things like that will continue to keep the relationship strong. But the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and particularly the settlements, will remain a thorn in the relationship for any future administration.
Ilan Goldenberg, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Senior Fellow, Director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times.